Chapter 6. The cool, smooth skin of the bright water was delicious to my feet, and I walked on it for about an hour, making perhaps a couple of hundred yards. Then the going became different. The current grew swifter. Great flakes or islands of foam came swirling down towards me, bruising my shins like stones if I did not get out of their way. The surface became uneven, rounded itself into lovely hollows and elbows of water, which distorted the appearance of the pebbles on the bottom, and threw me off my balance, so that I had to scramble to shore. But as the banks hereabouts consisted of great flat stones, I continued my journey without much hurt to my feet. An immense yet lovely noise vibrated through the forest. Hours later I rounded a bend and saw the explanation. Before me, green slopes made a wide amphitheatre, enclosing a frothy and pulsating lake into which, over many coloured rocks, a waterfall was pouring. Here once again I realized that something had happened to my senses, so that they were now receiving impressions which would normally exceed their capacity. On earth, such a waterfall could not have been perceived at all as a whole. It was too big. Its sound would have been a terror in the woods for 20 miles. Here, after the first shock, my sensibility took both, as a well-built ship takes a huge wave. I exulted. The noise, though gigantic, was like giants' laughter, like the revelry of a whole college of giants together laughing, dancing, singing, roaring at their high works. Near the place where the fall plunged into the lake, there grew a tree. Wet with the spray, half veiled in foam boughs, flashing with the bright innumerable birds that flew among its branches, it rose in many shapes of billowy foliage, huge as a Fenland cloud. From every point apples of gold gleamed through the leaves. Suddenly my attention was diverted by a curious appearance in the foreground. A hawthorn bush, not 20 yards away, seemed to be behaving oddly. Then I saw that it was not the bush, but something standing close to the bush, and on this side of it. Finally I realized that it was one of the ghosts. It was crouching, as if to conceal itself from something beyond the bush, and it was looking back at me and making signals. It kept on signing to me to duck down. As I could not see what the danger was, I stood fast. Presently, the ghost, after peering around in every direction, ventured beyond the hawthorn bush. It could not get on very fast because of the torturing grasses beneath its feet, but it was obviously going as fast as it possibly could, straight for another tree. There it stopped again, standing straight upright against the trunk, as though it were taking cover. Because the shadow of the branches now covered it, I could see it better. It was my bowler-hatted companion, the one whom the big ghost had called Ikey. After it had stood panting at the tree for about 10 minutes and carefully reconnoitred the ground ahead, it made a dash for another tree, such a dash as was possible to it. In this way, with infinite labour and caution, it had reached the great tree in about an hour. That is, it had come within 10 yards of it. Here it was checked. Round the tree grew a belt of lilies, to the ghost an insuperable obstacle. It might as well have tried to tread down an anti-tank trap as to walk on them. It lay down and tried to crawl between them, but they grew too close, and they would not bend. And all the time it was apparently haunted by the terror of discovery. At every whisper of the wind it stopped and cowered. Once, at the cry of a bird, it struggled back to its last place of cover. But then desire hounded it out again, and it crawled once more to the tree. I saw it clasp its hands and writhe in the agony of its frustration. The wind seemed to be rising. I saw the ghost wring its hands and put its thumb into its mouth, cruelly pinched, I doubt not, between two stems of the lilies when the breeze swayed them. Then came a real gust. The branches of the tree began to toss. A moment later, and half a dozen apples had fallen round the ghost and on it. He gave a sharp cry, but suddenly checked it. I thought the weight of the golden fruit where it had fallen on him would have disabled him, and certainly for a few minutes he was unable to rise. He lay whimpering, nursing his wounds. But soon he was at work again. I could see him feverishly trying to fill his pockets with the apples. Of course it was useless. One could see how his ambitions were gradually forced down. He gave up the idea of a pocketful. Two would have to do. He gave up the idea of two. He would take one, the largest. He gave up that hope. He was not looking for the smallest one. He was trying to find if there was one small enough to carry. The amazing thing was that he succeeded. When I remembered what the leaf had felt like when I tried to lift it, I could hardly help admiring this unhappy creature when I saw him rise, staggering to his feet, actually holding the smallest of the apples in his hands. He was lame from his hurts, and the weight bent him double, yet even so, inch by inch, still availing himself of every scrap of cover, he set out on his Via Dolorosa to the bus, carrying his torture.
"Fool! Put it down!"
said a great voice suddenly. It was quite unlike any other voice I had heard so far. It was a thunderous yet liquid voice. With an appalling certainty, I knew that the waterfall itself was speaking, and I saw now, though it did not cease to look like a waterfall, that it was also a bright angel who stood, like one crucified, against the rocks, and poured himself perpetually down towards the forest with loud joy.
"Fool," he said, "put it down. You cannot take it back. There is not room for it in hell. Stay here and learn to eat such apples. The very leaves and the blades of grass in the wood will delight to teach you."
Whether the ghost heard or not, I don't know. At any rate, after pausing for a few minutes, it braced itself anew for its agonies, and continued with even greater caution till I lost sight of it.